late January.
Test one, two.
Rock the blazer over.
Oh, well, Ron is here. Okay, he snuck in.
We'll call the IT committee meeting to order and invite the roll to be called.
Chairman Owens.
Here.
Representatives Koppelman, Olson, Thorson.
Here.
Tolman.
Olson's here.
Weiss.
Here.
Senators Robinson, Davison.
Here.
Marcelet, Rust.
Here.
Shibley.
Here.
And Chief Information Officer Mike Ressler.
Here.
Mr. Chairman, we have a quorum.
Thank you. All right, I presume everyone had opportunity to review the minutes from September 9th and consider them.
Move to accept minutes.
Second.
Okay, I have a motion and a second. Any comments, concerns, questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion passes. And that brings us to our first presenter today, Mr. Ressler, Chief Information Officer. Welcome, Mike.
Good morning, Chairman Owens and members of the Legislative IT Committee. My name is Mike Ressler. I am the Chief Information Officer with the Information Technology Department. And this afternoon, almost said this morning, I got a number of topics that I will cover. I will go through them quickly so that I don't bore you. The first item on the agenda is to talk about ITD's annual report. It's a document that we produce every year. And for probably the last 3 or 4 years, we stopped printing them. And so about 11 o'clock this morning, I sent you all a link. If you wanted to follow along, you feel free to click on that link. Otherwise, it is out on our webpage. And at any point in time, if you have time and have an interest to look at those or that document and have questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them. I will go through it a little quicker. For those of you who are on the budget section, I go through it very quickly there. I'll bore you a little bit and make you listen to just a couple items that I think are important. And again, if you have any questions throughout that, I'd be happy to answer them. So one of the items that we cover in our annual report, we have done surveys for many, many years. It's one of the best metrics we have that determine whether or not we're meeting the needs of the customers we're serving, which of course is state government as well as county and education. And so we worry sometimes that we survey too much because the last thing we want to do is spam our customers. But you'll see in the annual report, we identify some of those measures that we think are high-level measures that are critical. On page 3, you can see that. We have a number of them there. Those are measures that we trend from year to year. If you jump to page 4, it has the executive summary. I focused primarily in a couple areas. In my executive summary, I talked about security heavily, talked about managing projects and the cloud, the future of cloud, which you can read, and I'll talk to in a couple of the sections. Page 5, as you probably remember, Information Technology Department has a number of programs in our budget, and that's what we call their statewide alliances. Some of those alliances are the Education Technology Council, EduTech. Jody French will be here today. She'll speak briefly about some of the progress we're making in those areas, as well as the Health Information Technology Program. This is where we had criminal justice information sharing, if you remember. And just a reminder that that program is no longer in ITD's budget now. It was moved over to the Attorney General's office starting this biennium, which I think was a good move and seems to be going very well. Page 6 then starts the divisions inside ITD, and one of the divisions is the Enterprise Services. Again, a lot of different programs in that division, like the Geographic Information Sharing Program, Enterprise Project Management Office, Business Intelligence, State Longitudinal Data Sharing. Tracy Corsmo usually presents. He's not presenting today, giving you an update on the SLDS program, but a lot happening in that area. One of the areas that I did want to just mention was project management. I think probably the one item that makes legislators the most frustrated, as well as probably state agencies, is when we have a large IT project that doesn't go as planned. And so I'm here to tell you today that I really believe we've got a good trend going, and I hope I don't jinx it. But as you can see, we had 7 projects closed in the July 14th through the June 15th timeframe. 6 of those 7 projects came in on time and on budget. The 7th one came in over time behind the schedule, but did come in under budget. And so I think one of the things we're doing a better job of in state government is we're doing a better job of the planning up front and setting the proper expectations versus saying, geez, this system is so old and we need to get this in yesterday, so we get aggressive like most people do and then put out unrealistic dates in budgets. And then, of course, are surprised when stuff's not going as planned, and that's when you guys hear about that. But so 2014-15 timeframe, I think, was a pretty successful timeframe. You're going to hear three agencies come and, or I think you only got two agencies talking today. You got Human Services and WSI, but at the last time we met, I talked a little bit about this new process that we were starting called business analysis or business process modeling. And so we've started to deploy that on these big projects, and there's been three agencies who have started it, who have actually gone through the effort. Workforce Software is one of them. So Brian, if you want to ask him any questions, I think he'd tell you it's been somewhat successful. He's been appreciative of going through the exercise. Grant Levi, of course, Department of Transportation. The FAST project, which is the motor vehicle project, is going very well. You guys, that project is actually a little bit under budget and a little bit ahead of schedule, and so very pleased with that. We got the Secretary of State project, which we all know has been a bit of a challenge, and so we're through the first phase of that project, and as a result of, I would say, proper planning, we had the first phase of that go on as planned. And so I'm just excited to say that there seems to be a positive trend to this. Now, of course, there's no silver bullet to any IT project, and at some point in time, my guess is something's going to happen, but I think we have enough evidence right now to say that if we can afford to take the time to plan, and the only reason you wouldn't be able to afford to do that would be when you have some requirements, usually federal government related, where they come in and say, by this date, you have to have this deployed. And Human Services sees that a lot. And, you know, I don't know what the solution is there, but I think at some point we got to shake CMS or the top levels and say, I'm not sure that's always working, because not only North Dakota struggles with that, you see all the states struggling with that, but we can talk about that another time. Page 14 jumps into the next division, which is software development. That's the largest division inside ITD. If you remember, ITD is 340 people, large, very large agency, fifth largest executive branch agency. About 110 of those people reside in software development. Again, just a reminder, the way the law reads today, state agencies do not have to buy their applications from ITD. In fact, most of the time we prefer to buy something off the shelf, something that already exists. But in the event you have to do development, you're not required to buy from ITD. And so we see a lot of dollars, the big dollars being spent procuring software, which again, many times I think it's the right answer. Page 18 jumps into the next division. It's computer systems. That's the people that do the hosting of all the applications. So that's all of the servers, the AS400, the mainframe. Slowly, the mainframe starting to see applications come off that. I think Senator Robinson asked me last time if I know when that's going to happen. You know, I've been saying that 4 to 5 years, I believe, is when we'll have the final application. It's probably a DOT and a human service application that will be the last ones off. But again, I think a lot depends on, we got to get some of these current applications that we're working on done before we take on new applications. So maybe that 4 to 5 year time frame is still probably my best guess. They also have all the database analysts in that division as well. We've seen, that's probably the largest division, second largest division in ITD. They're a staff of about 70 people. This is something that I see changing in the future, though, because as I mentioned with cloud, everybody's seen that. Most of you understand what it is. But as we're starting to buy more applications from the vendor community is also the ones doing the hosting of that application and not giving us the opportunity to host it, say, in our data center. Again, not a bad thing necessarily, but I definitely see a transition over time where that division inside ITD is going to have to change its skill set and or reduce staff. Not sure how that'll all work, but as those applications start getting hosted up in the cloud. On page...
Mike, you're talking about software as a service.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, software as a service is a good one, correct?
Okay, so how is this going to affect security of the information in that?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that's a component that is, we are looking through, we're calling this our brokering role. We believe that's a responsibility that ITD needs to generate. and build a service behind that, because security is a major component. What we're seeing today is there are some vendors who are providing software as a service that have outstanding security, and then, of course, everybody who does it says they have outstanding security. I can't tell you we've found vendors that don't have good security, but my guess is there's vendors out there that are probably not real mature in that area. And so that's something we have to be very careful of before we just allow an application to leave, let's say, our data center and go to a cloud provider.
And I guess really what my question is do you have a process, or have y'all considered creating a process in which you can test and verify the security of a vendor that you're considering for software as a service?
Chairman Owens, great question. I think today what we've put in place is something called a rubric. It's really just a template of about 40 to 50 items with questions that we're asking. And we sit down with the vendor and we make sure that the vendor's answering all these questions. I'll be honest with you, about every so many weeks, a new question pops up that we think hadn't thought of that, and so we add that to our list. Actual testing, Dan, I hate to put you on the spot. Can you answer that maybe better? Dan Sipes.
So my name is Dan Sipes, Representative Owens. I think on the security side, as we contract for those software as a services, we're trying to add certain things to the contract. What you'll find, though, as far as actually testing the security, many of the large vendors will preclude you in the contract from doing that, because as they look at, let's say, 100 different customers that they're contracting with, they can't afford the overhead of all 100 customers testing. But what they do is they'll get like a SOC 2 audit, or they might be FedRAMP certifications or other things. So those are things, if we can't test, then we're looking to build into the contract that way we get SOC 2 audits and we get full disclosure of what the auditor did to test the controls that we have in place. Some of those we have to sign NDAs so we can see their security procedures and policies that they have in place. And so those are the things that we're looking at when Mike talked about the rubric, and then putting those things into the contract where we can.
Okay, well, thank you. The SOC 2 answered part of my question too, because I'm familiar with that in another arena. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan. The next division is our network services division. And again, this is the division responsible for all the network connectivity. And so the way the state law reads today is if you're an educational entity, or a county government or state entity, you have to buy your connectivity from ITD, and so it's a mandate. And I think the beauty to that is we've been able to pool all those demands, and actually then when we go out with our RFP, which I'll talk about, that's the last item I want to talk about. It was a question I think Senator Robinson had asked about the DCN contract, so I'll touch on it there. But it's allowed the state of North Dakota, I believe, to have a very robust network, because that's a big chunk of money that goes to whoever the winning vendor is. And I think when we compare what we have in North Dakota, for those of you who heard me talk too many times probably, but I always brag about that relationship, because I don't know another state that has it as good as us. There's some that have probably matured to what we have in our state, but I think the partnerships that we have with our local telcos, Dakota Carrier Network, CenturyLink, it's second to none when it comes to how other states are operating. So I'll talk more about that in a minute. In the annual report, we also talk about, we have a human resource section, which of course is critical, because without this body, this group of people right here, right, they keep us focused to some extent and make sure we practice good HR policies. And without our people, we have nothing to sell, right? So that we're all about selling knowledge at ITD. And you've heard me talk about this increased trend of turnover, and this graph will display that. So it is still of great concern to me personally, because as you can see, we've done pretty well in the past. We are starting to hit that 8% mark. The difference between 2015 and say 2012 is all of a sudden now when we have openings, as I mentioned at the last meeting that we had, we're not getting the applicants anymore. And that hasn't been the case for many, many years. We've always been blessed that when we had turnover, not only did we get applicants, we had really good applicants. Many of the applicants were experienced people wanting to come back to North Dakota, or maybe they wanted to work for ITD. I don't really believe that was the reason, but we're going to maybe think that sometimes. But it's been very positive, because we've always had good staff. We didn't have unfilled positions for long. What I did want to mention, though, in this graph, so I'm worried about it going forward. We have job openings out there. I don't know if we're using all kinds of forums to try and advertise, whether it be the radio, whether it be the internet, whether it be these people that go out and look for people. and I'm not so sure we're seeing a big increase as a result of any of the methods being used. It's obvious in the technology field, there's a demand for these people today, and I think salaries are up all over the country, and these people can pretty much go get jobs, especially if they want to leave the state of North Dakota. They can make a lot of money today. But one of the items I wanted to bring to your attention on here that we usually don't talk about because you got to be careful how you say it, but I kind of want you to pay attention to that involuntary turnover. And so what that really is, you guys, is ITD has always taken very seriously that because we, in a sense, are selling our people, and we have an hourly rate for most of our staff or a service that we're providing that has a per unit fee, if those people aren't performing, our customers, the other agencies, are pretty quick to remind us that, hey, we're paying you for something and we're not getting any value for it. And so we've always taken very seriously that if we have people that aren't performing, we get them on performance plans, and if that doesn't work, very quickly we get them out because we can't afford to be paying them, in a sense, if they're not bringing in revenue. And so we always take the belief at first that, okay, somehow we've miscommunicated to the employee and it's somehow a management issue, so we got to deal with that first. But as you can see, there are times when maybe it isn't a management issue. Maybe we have an individual who's in a position that maybe they're just not competent or capable of providing that service. So I show that only because I think sometimes state government gets stereotyped as though, well, if you want a job forever, go get a job in state government and, you know, you can never be terminated. I don't believe that's the case anymore. Not only at ITD, I think that's very true in many state agencies, but enough said about that. You can see the breakdown. If anybody's wondering what other is, other's death. We used to be a very young division or department, and fortunately we got a lot of very experienced people, but as they get older, the inevitable does come around sometimes, and that's what the other is. So
I thought that was just you and higher ed stealing each other's employees.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I think higher ed does a lot more stealing than we do. So, and Lisa's not here, but Darren can relay that message back. On page 26, we have our section dedicated to security, and we'll talk a little bit about security in a minute here, but very important. It's been the number one initiative, I will say, for sure, at least the last 4 years. And again, feeling somewhat confident again. For a while there, pretty nervous because it seemed like every day you opened the paper or heard the, you know, an article on the newspapers or magazines, somebody's being breached. And we're feeling pretty good. We're spending a lot of time and effort trying to find it. So it isn't like we're not looking, right? Sometimes I think private sector companies, nobody really wants to come out and say we're going to disclose that we've been breached. And so if you don't look for it and the bad actor hasn't gone out and advertised that they've hacked you, maybe it goes undisclosed. But I think the way the industry is working today, there's great penalties if you don't disclose and you know about it. And so I think the industry as a whole is out there putting more resources to saying, can we look internally and see if we're being hacked? And so we're spending great effort in that, and we're doing okay so far. Final section of our annual report is on administration of the divisions, and so that's the accounting aspect. We have records management for the state of North Dakota, as well as a number of other small little programs that you can read there. I always like these pie charts. These pie charts, as you know, ITD receives its revenue from our customers because, as I said, we bill out services. These two pie charts give you a breakdown as to, well, first of all, what agencies are spending the money at ITD, who are we providing the services for, and then the second pie chart shows what service that we're actually providing and the percentage of revenue that comes in that way. If you compare that, because it's been in every annual report for the last number of years, I'm not sure there's a whole lot of change. Probably a slight increase in the education. It seems like there's a real demand, especially in the K-12 world, for IT expertise. And to be realistic, we just don't have the people to dedicate the time to probably service all the work that's out there. But that's probably the piece that I could see continually growing over time. And then to wrap up the annual report, on page 30, we have rate comparisons because that's something we take very seriously. We compare our rates to other states, primarily the states around us, because we really can't compare as easily to the private sector, meaning we should always be cheaper than the private sector because they have a profit component built into their rates. We do not, so we should be cheaper. But it's sometimes fun to compare to other states to see how we're doing in comparison to them. page 31, then we do our trending, which says, well, we've been charging this for a CPU second in 1995, well, what it was in 97, 99, and so on, so you can see the trending. We talk about our strategy map on page 32. We use that when we do our strategic planning. We do that every 2 years. We're going to be starting up again here in January for the 17-19 biennium for strategic business plan. And then again, we have 8 high-level performance measures on page 33. We've been trending those ever since we started doing an annual report, which was in the late 90s. And then our financial statements on page 35 for any accountants that like that stuff. And then we have our guiding principles, which is what we claim drives the employees at ITD. And so, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that's a very quick overview of the annual report. And if anybody has any questions, I sure try and answer them.
Are there any questions?
Okay. That's...
You've done a good job.
And if you have questions after you look through it, please give me a call. I'd be happy to answer them. I have one slide just to update you. If you remember during the last session, there was legislation passed that said there will be 19 state agencies now that will be required to get their desktop support services from ITD. And I believe all 19 were voluntary. They said we would be willing to do that. As of today, we have 12 of those 19 done. And I'm here to give you some good news. I believe that the employees who are providing this service to these agencies have said it's gone probably better than they expected. And so many of these agencies, even though they're small, did not have really any desktop support service. And so what they ended up doing was having whoever's kind of got time or has the most knowledge do stuff like this in their agency. And so we were somewhat concerned that that was going to create some problems, but it has gone very smooth. I personally have tried to contact these agencies just to say, hey, can you give me your gut feel as to, do you think this is, are you getting value for the money you're spending? And so far, everybody's been very positive. And so I think that's exciting. So I hope to have the remaining 7 agencies done by the end of June of 2016, and so they'll all be in. And then the service is available for any state agencies who is willing to put it in their budget. I don't foresee us going after any agencies in the future and mandating it. It will be kind of on a voluntary basis. The next item that I want to talk about, I've kind of been giving you guys an update on that initiative that was put in ITD's budget. It's called the North Dakota Radio Interoperability Network, is how the legislation read. And if you remember, there was $1.5 million put in ITD's budget to do the study. And so what we've done is I said right up front we would be using this body called the SIAC. Acronym stands for Statewide Interoperability Executive Committee. It is a committee that's in statute, and you can see the makeup of the people. Outstanding group of people. It is the public safety individuals. I can tell you now, because I honestly didn't know most of these people prior to me being engaged, but very passionate group of people, very much interested in not only doing what's right for them. In my opinion, they really are interested in what's right for the state of North Dakota. And so we went into this thing explaining right away that early on, I think there was this belief that somehow if they came to the governor and to the legislature, they could get the whole package funded for them. And, you know, that's back when the state actually had money, or a lot of excess money, let's call it that. I think we still have some dollars, but when the legislature was loud and clear, the governor was loud and clear saying, I'm not going to put that on my budget. If you remember, the number estimate at last biennium was like $160 million, so it was a very big price tag. And so this group has been working. And so what have we accomplished so far, kind of through the first 5 months? Of course, the SIAC has created what's called this feasibility charter. And so a lot of it's going to center around feasibility. Primarily, we're not going to ask for the Cadillac. They're not going to ask for the Cadillac, because I believe they know they're going to make a major contribution to whatever the final cost is, and they know they can't afford that. And so to me, that's been the beauty of this whole initiative, is everybody who's sitting down is saying, what is it we need? And I think the definition of need is really going to be correct when we're done, versus what is it that we want. And so I'm a little disappointed or sad kind of forecasting out based on, you know, our first 5 months of the revenue forecast. I'm not so sure any amount of money is going to be easy to ask for going into the next biennium, especially if things continue like this. And this is still a big ticket item. I mean, even if you could say, well, somehow the state can pay for the backbone component and the participants can pay for their radios and some of those things. I mean, we're still talking lots of money. So, but Again, what have we done so far? We put together an RFP to go out and, in a sense, say, what is it we want to try and get answers to for the next biennium? And we released that RFP, had a number of people reply to it, and then we awarded the RFP to the Winnie Vendor. Televate was the name of the company. They actually had won the original contract when we were doing the FirstNet initiative, where we were trying to get some answers for that. And so in all fairness to Televate, or to the others, I should say, they should have won, because they had a lot of knowledge based on the first contract they won. So, and they priced their current response accordingly. So I think it's a good thing. We've been very pleased with them prior, and I think so far in this, they've done an outstanding job. So this, you guys, is just a high level of some of the future tasks that we're going to try and accomplish over the next 6 months, so that we can determine what it is we're going to ask for, first to the governor, and then second, of course, what filters up to the legislature. But here's a number of items that we believe we got to get answers to. And for those of you who are involved, if you remember, we would like to have almost every question answered, like something as specific as, there are a number of tower owners that might not be state or county or government-owned facilities. And so how many towers do we need, and where should they be positioned? And if one is privately owned, let's go so far as to maybe even have an arrangement worked out. We probably wouldn't have a dollar amount necessarily determined. We surely couldn't sign a contract, because we have no authority to do that. But the idea was, if we got the funding and permission to proceed, everything would pretty much be in place that we, in a sense, could go out and start implementing almost immediately. And so it's a very aggressive plan, and I think we'll see how we're going. But I'm, again, just here to share with you that everybody's really working well together, and I think everybody believes that it's going to take some major contribution on their part.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Thorson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Mike, are these questions you're looking at here, is this something that Televate will look at now that they've been awarded the RFP, and what other things were in the RFP that they will need to come back to us with?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thorson, you know, I thought about giving you a copy of the RFP, and I'll get that to you. I can't necessarily give you all the examples of what was included in there. We had a subgroup of that SIAC who actually sat down and put that RFP together. They put about 2 months into that process to make sure they had all the right questions in there. And so, Representative Thorson, I'll deliver an RFP to all of you guys so you can see what it is that they are going to bring us. I felt like these were some of the high-level ones that you might be of interest to in.
Continue.
One other question, and it'll be in the RFP, I'm sure. What is their timetable for getting these tasks completed? Do you know that offhand?
I do. Mr. Chairman, Representative Thorson, I believe we asked for it to be completed by the end of June, because what we said is we had to have a budget ready, a plan with a budget ready by August 1st, because that's when ITD submits its information to the governor's office.
Okay. Just a comment. I mean, this is something that in our committee in the Government Operations Division of Appropriations, we spent a lot of time on. And it is a big price tag and a big ticket, but I think it's worthwhile to get the study in and see what at least we can start accomplishing, even with a tighter budget, because we did hear some examples of potential not-so-good things out there with agencies not being able to communicate with one another if there were a disaster or some kind of a threat to the homeland. I think it could certainly be an issue. So I look forward to seeing the results of that study.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thorson, if I can add, there's another primary reason this needs to be done is we got a lot of equipment that's going to be end of life out there. And so a number of these counties and public safety people are going to have to start making investments. And so coming from ITD, where we've had a lot of centralized authority on standards and buying services, buying brands or flavors of equipment, and then that's what state agencies are going to use. When you walk into this environment and you see there's no authority, there's no body really who can tell these guys what to do, they do the very best they possibly can. All of a sudden, you start getting all kinds of flavors of stuff out there, and it's obvious that, well, this stuff's not going to work. It's not going to be as compatible as it would as if somebody just stepped in and said, well, where's the leadership here? I learned quickly that leadership isn't just coming in and saying, oh, I got all the answers for you, and here's the flavors you need, because then you realize that, oh, there's a lot of pride in what these people do. And it's local ownership, right? Unless you're picking up the tab for them, they're going to have a say in what it is they want to buy. But even though I don't believe we'll get to that point, state of South Dakota, I've learned, that's how they've approached it, and maybe they hit some good times because they've had this in place for many years. But they pay the bill. And I've often thought, if you're paying the bill, then you can dictate what it is you want. And sometimes, if you're looking at just efficiencies, I kind of think, ooh, that's the ideal model to have. But realistically, that's just a lot of money. And I'm not sure all the locals want that. Meaning, nobody really wants to give up total control of everything they have. And so it's going to be a fun exercise going through this. And I, again, if we don't work well together, it will not be successful. Through the first 5 months, this partnership is as strong as any that I've seen, and so I'm very excited about that. I think in the future, maybe in the March timeframe, we may be far enough along to where we could actually have some of those people come and give updates from their perspective, if you're interested, Mr. Chairman, because what they say is going to mean a whole lot more than what I say. I really believe we're kind of just at that early stage, so it's probably not the right time for them to come in and start begging necessarily. More just an update on the process we're making, what's the purpose of this, so.
And the RFP's already out, but it had a well-defined statement of work, and that's the key right there, the statement of work.
So, it did, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, if you'll share that and let people see what the statement of work was.
You'll have it today.
Thank you.
And then I wanted to talk briefly, since we had our last meeting, you have seen that the governor created something called the Cybersecurity Task Force, and there's the makeup of the membership. And so, again, I sound like I'm excited about everything, but this has really gone well so far. And why do I believe this is a great idea is, as you can see, the names that are on this list are all the leaders of the agencies. And so the beauty was, because in our SITAC meetings, Statewide Information Technology Advisory Committee, which Chairman Owens is on, security was always a major component of that. But we've had two meetings now where the only focus of this group is security. And these guys show, and ladies show all the time, right? There's nobody who sends a deputy. And so that's important to me. I would say every one of these agencies has security at the top of their list prior to even this task force being put together. But I think having the governor say he's interested in this, and then the lieutenant governor who is facilitating the meetings, the first two meetings have gone very well. The first two meetings were the easy meetings. It was all about awareness and identifying roles and responsibilities. And so in ITD, we've had security as kind of a major focal point for many, many years. So we've always understood the roles and responsibilities, but I'm not so sure we've always done a good job communicating that out to the agencies, or internally in the agencies, they've understood sometimes what their role and responsibility is. I can assure you now, with this interest from this group of people, that will be well understood, and then we can continue to go forward. I foresee having probably six more meetings before summertime with this group, and the hard stuff's going to come now, and that is going to be, what is it that we're going to start deploying? Whether it be technologies, probably not so much, but priorities with regards to policy and some of that kind of stuff. And so I'm excited, because when we bring something to the legislature, it will have the buy-in from all these people. And of course, our first challenge as a state agency always is to get the governor interested in something and get him excited. Well, being he's driving this, that will be a given. And so then when we present something to you, you'll at least know that everybody was on board and this is what we agreed to. So lot of good things there. And then the last item I wanted to talk about, and this actually is in response to Senator Robinson's question at the last meeting, was to come and just give you a little bit of an update on how our network component works in state government. And so we call it StageNet. And if you've ever seen that little logo up there, that is what it stands for, of course, is North Dakota Statewide Technology Access for Government and Education Network. This network has all of government on it, all of county government on it, all of K-12 on it, and all of higher education on this network. And so again, you don't see that duplicated in too many states. So just the fact that this partnership has been strong for so many years, I think is a real win-win for everybody. And so what do we have? We have a process where we put out an RFP, because we don't lay our own fiber, right? The state doesn't own fiber and put it in the ground. And so every roughly 2 to 6 years, and the reason I say 2 to 6 is we have the opportunity to go out for an RFP every two, but we have the opportunity to extend current contracts beyond. And so depending on what we're seeing in the industry, it may say, hey, you know what, we think prices have come down, let's put another RFP out on the street. Or there are times when we think, you know what, there hasn't been a lot that's changed, so these are a lot of work and take a lot of energy. We may just do an extension. But when we put out an RFP, there's those three primary areas that we look for, and one would be, of course, backbone connectivity. And for those of you seeing the maps, we have this ring that goes from Minot to Bismarck to Fargo to Grand Forks. It's called a self-healing ring. If there's ever a cut, it reverses, and in a sense, we have very little downtime as a result because of that. Then there's the endpoint connectivity, and today we have a little over 425 end locations or buildings that we connect, which seems like a lot to me. I mean, when you think those are all education and governmental entities, that's a lot of entities, that we then provide a fiber connection to. In most cases, it's fiber. There's still some copper that's out there, but not in many locations anymore. And then, of course, the big exciting piece of the network is the internet, because once we get on the network, usually where are we going to go? We're going to head out to the internet. And so the way we've architected the internet is we have a connection that leaves out of Bismarck and one that leaves out of Fargo, again with the idea of it being self-healing should we ever lose one. And those go to two tier one locations. I believe Denver and Chicago are the two locations they go to. Currently, DCN was the winner of the last contract, and they have all three pieces. And so what we see for competition is CenturyLink has always had an interest in this. However, their presence is slowly, I think, decreasing in the state of North Dakota. And currently, all they've really responded to has been the internet component. Mid-Continent has been the entity that is definitely growing and expanding and been more aggressive trying to win a portion of this contract. They have responded to both the backbone component and the internet component. And honestly, this last time were very competitive. It was very close. Now, what they aren't capable of doing, Midco, is getting to every endpoint. You know, they have their specific locations where they are in our state, and they can get to those locations. DCN is the only entity that can hit every one of the endpoints. And why is that? It's because they are the consortium of all the telcos, right? And it's the telcos who are out in the rural community. What kind of money are we looking at? You can see those are big dollars. $3.9 million, roughly, is what we spend each year on network. But over and above that is something called the E-Rate program that the state, all states qualify for based on the free and reduced lunch that schools are capable of applying for. And that adds roughly another $1.4 million that goes to DCN. And so you can see it's almost a $6 million per year network. And very robust. We have very good service, very few outages, and I think the partnership we have is unbelievable. You know, our new building that we're sitting in up here, right next door is DCN, so anytime we're not happy, we just glare over at them and they immediately react. So, but it's always been a good partnership. I mentioned the internet a little bit. You can see the growth in the internet, and so we got all the stats on how we can break this down, but definitely seeing major growth, of course, in the education field. I'm not so sure state government has seen a whole lot of growth over the years, but K-12 and higher education, I think, continues to be the leader when it comes to watching Netflix, I'm guessing, Darren, at midnight, whatever the students are doing, but everything is done today online. So you can see the growth. I don't see this growth pattern stopping anytime soon. And so, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that completes the topics I was going to talk about. I'd be happy to answer any questions or gather more information for a future meeting.
Any questions? Representative Olson. Tolman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Coming back up to security, I was just reading the audit from May 6th, and you were talking about security and your confidence in it, and significant findings are lacking formal risk assessment framework and no periodic review of enabled ports and services. And I know this isn't the audit committee and review committee, but I'm just wondering if that the security you talked about before has solved those two major findings in that report, or
Mr.
what
Chairman,
we've done to
Representative Tolman, if I can ask Dan Seitz to come back up, because I could guess, but he can tell you the facts.
So, Representative Tolman, on the two findings that you talked about, the formal risk assessment, most of our focus to date has been on application risk assessments. We're currently evaluating two different products to do what I would call more of, I would call a general controls risk assessment of the department overall. But we've done risk assessments mostly for DHS applications in response to some federal things. So we're working on that. We're looking at a product from a company called Helix, and then the federal government has a CSET product that we're looking at and trying to find something that is not a one-time endeavor. If we do something that's a one-time endeavor, it doesn't benefit us. We need to find something that we can do repetitively that then corresponds and dovetails into our security framework, which I've talked about before. Tell me the second one, because I've forgotten it already.
Periodic review, Mr. Chairman, periodic review of enabled ports and services.
That one, I believe, we are working on more on an infrastructure piece by piece. So there's some policies in our framework around configuration management that we've developed in response to that. And so I think you'll see that implemented by the time the next audit comes around, which that's the State Auditor's Office, I believe, and that gets done every 2 years. So we'll have another SOC 2 audit that's done about a year from now, I think, Don. Does that sound about right? So that gets done every 2 years, and on the off year, we have the Mantech security audit, which just kicked off this month. So.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I know the agenda says a break at 1:00. We're ignoring that. I mean, so if you need to break, get up and do whatever, but we're just going to press on. That brings us to our 110 agenda, large information technology projects, and I believe the first one is Bank of North Dakota.
All right. Hi, my name is Justin Data. I'm the Enterprise Services Division Manager responsible for the Project Management Office at ITD. And what I'm going to do is take you first through some large project highlights, and I'm going to talk briefly about the Bank of North Dakota startup report. They're not here to present it today, however, it is in your packet, and you can go take a look at that at your leisure, and if you have questions for them, we can have them come back at a future meeting to discuss any concerns. All right, okay. Okay, in your handouts, there was a link to the summary report and the cover letter that goes with that. I'm just going to talk about a few highlights that are on there to kind of wrap it up, and then you can take a look at it in more detail when you feel like it. And if you have follow-up questions in the future, you could always ask, or if you find those today. So for the third quarter of 2015, two big things occurred. One is that the Department of Human Services MMIS project was launched, and I believe Jenny is going to be here to talk about that today. And additionally, ITD launched a billing system rewrite project, which is currently in use and working just fine. Other highlights include that three projects finished planning and began executing. Bank of North Dakota managed file transfer and the WSI system replacement project, which you'll find out what phase two project one means, and one that seems to not be written on here, which is the eligibility system modernization, the phase one of another iterative project that is going on right now. And Jenny Witham will also be here to give a startup report on that. Okay, overall, there are 13 active major projects, of which 10 have a status of green and 3 have a status of yellow. And you can see that is a link to where the cover letter is. So overall, things are going quite well at this moment. Nothing is in the red. Okay, before we get into the startup and closeout reports, I need to give you a little bit of background about them. Previously, or historically, I guess you would say, when we distributed startup reports and closeout reports, the approach was that all of the planning would be done up front. So you would take a certain amount of time, you would plan as much as you can, in fact, you'd plan out the entire project, you would baseline that plan, you would submit the plan to oversight, and then you would start executing on the actual work, the construction of the project itself. When you were done with that, you would measure against the baseline and give a closeout report and say, this is how we did for the overall project. Okay, that seems to work, and I alluded to this the last time we met a few months ago. That works pretty well for projects that are not in the multi-million or the multi-year kind of category. Because what happens is that, as you know, on all significant projects, there's a certain amount of change that gets introduced either into the business environment, into the technical environment, and we have to address those. Some of them can even come from outside environments such as CMS, federal entities, and regulation changes. So what we have started doing now with our biggest projects is we have developed an iterative startup closeout process. And if you remember correctly, last time I was here, I passed out a blank template of that, so you can get an example of what it's going to look like. Well, today we're going to have two projects, the two very first projects that are planning under this methodology, come and present to you. So what the iterative process is that instead of just planning, then executing, and then closing, we plan, and we execute, and then we cycle around in what we call iteration. So you plan, instead of 7 years of work, you will plan maybe a year of work. When you were done with that, executing on that year of work, you will come back, cycle around, and plan on the next year of work, whatever it is, the durations or costs or groupings that you've determined. So the message there is that as projects get larger and more complex, accurately forecasting over long periods of time can become impossible. Therefore, we want to control manageable portions, these iterations, while providing a mechanism for agencies and projects to maneuver effectively to account for future change, meaning they could come back and continually replan. So when you see the startup reports that you're going to get in just a moment, we're trying to tell a long story. So the first part of it is for that expanse of time, that 7 years, 10 years, 5 years, whatever it is, what's the roadmap? So you look at the map to kind of see where the project, we envision it going. And then as the report unfolds, you will see what is the specific baseline that we have been able to plan, capture, and manage and measure against for this time period, maybe a year, maybe 8 months, maybe 2 years, but it's a smaller increment than the overall project in general. Okay.
It sounds like what you're describing is either agile or spiral software development, so that you have an iterative approach and you can manage risk better.
Mm-hmm.
Am I off track here? Or?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, you are completely on track. It is an agile-like approach. I wouldn't go as far as to call it agile because I think when you look at agile, the iterations are very small. Maybe they're 2 weeks or 3 weeks or 1 week. It's the same concept, however, that you can break it up into smaller portions. Maybe they're months or years. But the idea is to have something more controllable and easier to manage from a risk standpoint.
So my question is, while it allows you to manage risk, because I know I deal with this, how do you fight scope creep? Because over time, it's, you know what, we should try this.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that is certainly going to be a challenge, just as it is with traditional waterfall type project that we've been doing. What we have done with the report is by developing, what we hope is that by developing that roadmap piece is that we can give the agency the tools to do enough strategic planning and thinking about the project. So from a high level, they're at least establishing what is that scope over 5, 7, 10 years. That will help mitigate it. However, like any project, it's not going to erase all possibility of there being scope creep. In addition to that, what you'll see is there may be a budget in this roadmap that is beyond perhaps what has been allocated or what funding is available now from other sources. So keep that in mind, is that we're expecting that a project of that duration can change, and we expect it will have some change. And the idea is that we want the agency, as they perform these baselines and they finish them, to keep coming back, keeping you informed and saying, well, through a year, this is what happened to us, and maybe we don't need the scope in phase two, or maybe the scope in phase two is different to actually meet our business objectives, and previously maybe we wouldn't have addressed that as quickly or as effectively as the hope.
No, I appreciate all that. I was hoping you'd give me a silver bullet to eliminate it, though.
Yeah, I wish I had one. I'm still looking for it, but...
No, I completely understand. Okay, thank you.
Okay, so that's the concept, and let's see. Okay, so like I said, with the Bank of North Dakota, they have started up their managed file transfer project. That one is going to be managed in a traditional fashion. They've set a budget. It's around $500,000. They kicked that off in the last quarter, and the startup report is in your packets. Please take a look. If you have any questions, we can get them back here to discuss anything. However, the two that agencies that we brought in today, the first one is Workforce Safety, and the second one is the Department of Human Services. So I'll give you an opportunity to ask any of the questions of me, and if not, I'll turn it over.
Any questions? Seeing none, you were very thorough. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Next up is Tim Shenfish from Workforce Safety and Insurance.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Tim Shenfish. I'm the IT Director at Workforce Safety. I'm here today to talk about our system replacement program and specifically talk about the first project in that program. And this is the startup report for the IT committee. A little bit about the program background, the business need of our project. Our business need, our main driver for this project is to, or the entire program, will replace our core business applications. We want to provide current industry web-based technology for our core systems that support our injury services area, our employer services area, and we want to replace our existing client server-based systems. And we want to provide a system that will give us enhanced reporting and accessibility to information. A little bit of background, to summarize, from early 2013 through 2014, our executive steering committee directed that we complete six steps after the termination of our previous project, and those six steps were completed and approved by the ESC. And then on October 2nd, 2014, our executive steering committee approved moving forward with a Major Oak, which was a consultant that we had recommended to implement what we call our evolutionary approach to replace our core systems. And a detailed planning phase, which was our phase one, was completed January through June of 2015. Again, our program started executing in July of this year. It is a phased approach. Our first phase was a very detailed planning of our entire program. We are now on our phase two, and we are on project one of that phase two. We have four phases, and each phase has various projects in them. The phase two we're in right now is common systems. Phase three is claims. Phase three is policy. Phase four is claims, and then the fifth phase is like a final phase for completing the whole project. We believe the evolutionary approach minimizes our risks and costs, and each project will incrementally replace our existing application user interface of our core systems with a web-based interface while we retain all of our process logic and all the business logic that's on the back end on the database. Usable functionality, we will be putting into production approximately every 6 to 10 months. That's ties to each project. And then we did have a naming for our new system. We are calling it appropriately the Claims and Policy System, or CAPS. Look at our current project. We are in phase two. This project one, it's a shared components application refacing, and also we did a database consolidation. Each project has its own detailed scope and budget that are developed, and the scope for this first project is to reface our existing what we call work manager forms functionality, and we also consolidated our policy and our claims databases into one database. That project began in July of this year, and it's scheduled to go till May 19th. As of December 1st, we're ahead of schedule, 30% ahead of schedule, and our baseline budget is a little over $1.6 million, and as of December 1st, we are 20% under budget. And the project itself is about 54% complete. We have a lot of key objectives that we had in place when we were looking at planning and what we were going to do. A sample of some of those key objectives: we wanted to provide current web-based technology to support our core applications. And one main item that was very apparent from the business, we wanted to maintain or improve our existing business functionality. We do not want to have any loss of our efficiencies in that area. We want to continue to operate at our current or enhanced levels, and we do not want to add additional staff. We also want to enhance customer and staff accessibility to our policy and claims information and our applications and the corresponding data. We want our internal staff to have access to the core business systems from anywhere where there's an internet connection, and we also want to have our external customers to have self-service access to our data relevant to their account or ID. So that is my startup report for the Project One. Entertain any questions if you may have.
Any questions from anyone? Is it possible that you could tell me anything about the previous contract and the status of the activities surrounding that right now? Or would you rather someone else do that at a different time?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I figured there may be a question on that, and from our legal counsel, pretty much what we are allowed to say is that settlement discussions are ongoing, and the counsel assured that if there's settlement that can't be reached out of court, that we're ready to proceed fully to present our case to the jury. But discussions are ongoing.
Long sentence for no. Okay.
The legal way of doing things, right?
All right, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. A small little department, Health and Human Services. Oh. Well, why don't we, it's 1 o'clock. I'll be doggone. You're smarter than I think. Why don't we take a 10-minute break then and see if you knew what was going to happen, didn't you, Adam? All right, we'll take a 10-minute, yeah, well, I just told everybody they could take a few minutes break, so we'll give everybody a few minute break. Be back, let's say at 5 after, everybody.
I'm so busy, I couldn't even eat lunch. We had the meeting during lunch.
When time did you do that? 1 o'clock.
Oh, for people.
We're hitting on.
We had a bunch of people looking.
So
that's no big deal.
Well, yeah, Deb was going to tell me. Carol Lee? Careful. No. No.
All right. Let's see, because I think everybody's still in the room. You know, they're just all standing around talking. call the meeting back to order. And we will invite, give everybody a second to get back to their locations. I have a suggestion. Never mind, Representative Weiss. Thank you.
Did your suggestion state it loud?
Welcome. The mic?
Oh, thank you. So Chairman Owens and members of the Information Technology Committee, I'm Jenny Witham, Director of the Information Technology Services for the Department of Human Services. And I appear before you today to provide the startup report related to the eligibility system modernization project and the status of the implementation of the Medicaid Management Information System replacement. So the startup report, we're going to go through a series of slides. And you have a copy of the slides in front of you, and then attached to the back of the slides are the is the actual report. So for the eligibility system background, just to give you an idea of what this project is all about, it is to create a single integrated eligibility system that for the following programs. So it's up there, the medical assistance, which is Medicaid, the Children's Health Insurance Program, otherwise known as CHIP, temporary assistance for needy families, supplemental nutrition assistance program, child care assistance, basic care assistance, and low-income home energy assistance program. So the eligibility determination systems that we have within the department, and it's a single system to determine eligibility for all of these programs. All Medicaid-related and common functionality, so functionality that's shared between the programs, those costs have a federal participation of 90% federal funds to a 10% state match, and approximately 80% of the system that we're building leverages this high level of federal match. Give you a little bit of the background. Then going to... So this is a project that we're going to adopt the new iterative approach. And so the startup report is really about phase one of the project. And phase one, this phase includes the functionality to support the Affordable Care Act and is scheduled to run through March of 2016. This phase includes many of the common components. So the ability to leverage that 90-10, we're building kind of a base system, a foundational system. And so this part of the project is running about $45 million. Phase two of the project, which will take a period of time to do the planning for the remaining programs, so all of the non-ACA. So there's still components of Medicaid that are left to be done, TANF, SNAP, all the other ones that we had just walked through. So the planning phase for that, which will include requirements, definition, and detailed design. So it's not just planning, it's actually getting into some of the software development lifecycle. We're estimating that that phase of the program will be about $25 million. And then the remaining phases, which will include the build-out of those other programs, because the common components have been done, it is a lesser build, so about $40 million to complete the construction for the other programs. That, the life cycle components that are engaged, that will be involved in for that phase of the project, is going to be, of course, the system configuration and development, system integration testing, user acceptance testing, training, and transition. And that is projected to be going live in the summer of 2017, so close to the end of this biennium. This is just a pictorial of what I just walked you through. Gives you an idea of how we see those phases relating to each other. That first set of arrows are related to the work that we're doing right now on the Affordable Care Act, and the star representing, star representing the go-live date. We will be in production with that, so that will get rolled out to the counties, and so we'll have a transition and warranty period, and we'll go into maintenance and operations for that first release. Then we'll start the planning, like I had talked about, including the requirements, verification, and design for the remaining programs and the construction work and FIT and UAT training. So that's how we see it relating to each other. The key objectives, which comes to the heart of a lot of the common components of the system, is that we're going to be creating a client portal to allow for no wrong door access to apply for services, create an option for clients to view enrollment status, benefit information, and view and update case information, and submit electronic correspondence and verification. So we'll have a much more public-facing component than our current systems have. A worker portal, which the counties will be using, as well as state staff, for an integrated eligibility worker workflow for case assignments, integrated referrals, notices, alerts, and case narratives within the current eligibility systems as appropriate. So we can share information more readily across programs as appropriate. And a provider portal to allow for the providers to update demographic information and submit payment requests. Now, the providers we're talking about here are the low-income home energy providers, so it's going to be the utilities. And for child care, so we're talking about the child care providers. It's not medical providers. Medical providers portal is on the MMIS, which I'll talk to you about next. The creation of the option for employment contractors to update demographic information and to submit client work activities for TANF and SNAP.
In reference to the no wrong door, real quick, what you're talking about is the client portal. They can put in their information, and they won't be turned around, oh, you know, you should be over here rather than over here. But my question is, do they have to pick what they're applying for, or is it going to be automatic? Oh, you qualify for this, this, and this.
The program will have a screener, so if the client is like, I wonder what I qualify for, they can put their information in and get it back, but that's not an actual application. It will give them an idea of whether or not they should go through the process of the full application. Then, and that's optional for them. But when they do apply, they choose what programs they want to apply for. And then finally, just continuing with the key objectives, the single eligibility system for all economic assistance programs that will provide sharing of information regarding clients interactively amongst its service programs, resulting in increased efficiency, ease of use, mobility of the application, and effective reporting for decision making. Are there any questions on the startup for the eligibility system?
Any questions? Representative Weiss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jenny, if I look at this right, you're estimating roughly $30 million of state dollars. Is that correct, or?
Chairman Owens and Representative Weiss, I should have that at my fingertips, but it would be roughly about that much, because if you're taking 80% and then 90%, yeah.
$110 million project, roughly, yep. So 88 is, and then 10%.
Some of the other programs do have federal match, so it's not going to be, it might be a little bit less than that, but.
Question, does some of the other 20% get a 50% match or any other match?
Yes, and the SNAP program, and I'm going to have to look to Carol, has a federal match. So that's about 13% of the build is SNAP, because there's a lot of rules associated with SNAP. TANF, I think, is all federal, 100% federal, and child care is, I think, 100% state. Right?
It may be a combination.
You know, I have, if you want to let me have a moment in between, I have the budget. I can give you exactly what the percentage is. I just don't have it at the top of my head. But that's roughly correct.
Any other questions? Please continue.
So I've written testimony here, but we've already gone through the first part of it, so I'm just going to jump to the Medicaid Systems Project, the post-production update. The North Dakota Health Enterprise MMIS, the Medicaid Management Information System implementation, has generally gone well, and DHS is completing an anticipated 3-month operation stabilization period. So we went live in October. The way that we had negotiated the post-go-live burn-in period with Xerox was for a 3-month stabilization. So we're about 2 months through that 3-month stabilization period. 11 provider payments have been completed for $178 million being paid to North Dakota Medicaid providers, Children's Health Insurance Plan providers, and health plans, and $43.4 million paid in regular monthly Medicaid expansion premium payments have been made from this system in the last few months. As expected, in implementation of this magnitude, there have been some system issues. The Medicaid providers have been very understanding, and the department is working to correct all the issues as quickly as possible. The state has also contracted with Xerox to provide a provider call center. The call center is working through high volumes, and the state staff is continuing to provide education and training to call center staff so that they can best serve the Medicaid providers and reduce wait time associated with the high call volumes. I have attached to that short testimony some slides that may help you to get a better feeling for the payments that we've been making. So the 11 payments that have taken place from early October until for approximately 2 months, it gives you week over week, and the first part of the month generally has seen larger payments because we make the nursing home payments at that time. But the main thing that we wanted you to understand from this slide, in addition to the payments that have gone out, is that our average payment in legacy was $22.1 million on a weekly basis, and the average payment in health enterprise has been slightly less. It's $20.1 million on average. So we're paying out, after the first 2 months, slightly less than what our average had been on legacy. And part of the reason is, if you want to flip to the next slide, is that we are having a higher rate of denials than what we had anticipated when we were doing our initial projections. And what this slide gives you is the top five reasons for denial. And our big hitter there, the very first one, is that the billing provider taxonomy is missing. So back in 2009, when the National Provider Identifier regulation was promulgated, the idea behind that was is that payers could not impose upon providers their own unique IDs, so that everybody had their own ID. Like Blue Cross Blue Shield would have an ID, Medicare would have an ID, we'd have an ID, and then the provider would have to know which ID to send in with which billing. So the idea behind the National Provider Identifier was is that providers could register for a single national provider ID, and then all payers would use that provider ID. And it's not quite that simple as just getting a single ID, because some providers have different services that they provide, especially if they're an integrated network. So what we do as a combination is we take the provider ID in combination with the taxonomy code, which says this is the rehab unit of Trinity Medical Center versus the inpatient hospital setting. And so the combination of that national provider ID and the taxonomy code identifies who the provider is. And that was something we did not implement back in 2009 in our legacy system because it was just too difficult. And so even though we accepted the national provider ID, we still requested providers to send the legacy Medicaid ID. When we went live with this new system, we're saying, okay, we're not going to depend on that legacy Medicaid ID, but you need to register, which they did when they enrolled, all of the taxonomy codes that you anticipate being able to bill with. So when we went through provider enrollment, they did identify their taxonomy codes and they correctly enrolled. And now what we're having in billing is when we started the billing, is what this represents is we are having a higher than anticipated volume of providers who are not providing the correct taxonomy code. So we're having to, either it's not present or it's the wrong taxonomy code or it doesn't comport with the procedures and the billings that are related to the billing. So that's an educational issue. It's probably our biggest issue. And if you look down the list, there is also the last one, it's still in the top five, is there's a billing provider taxonomy mismatch. The second one has to do with rendering providers, because the rendering provider has to provide the taxonomy code as well. And so that's been missing. So if you add up all of those three items, that's clearly our biggest denial problem. Referrals not being found and having a revenue provider type conflict are not as large of an issue. So I'm going to move on to the call center. We may come back to some questions there, but the final page of the presentation is the call center statistics. And like I had said in my testimony, we did contract with Xerox to provide a provider call center. Part of the reason is because we have a small provider relations staff. It's about three people. And we knew after we went live, we wouldn't be able to handle the volume of calls that may come in, because they're going to be asking about statuses and how to use the system. So that very first slide shows you how many calls have been handled. I think we had a low period there because of Veterans Day or something, was there was something that went on that dip, but what's probably more normal is right around the 1,500 calls. So the ABD is an abandonment rate, and that was one of our service level agreements, is that people wouldn't be on hold so long that they would just hang up. So it's a measure to say, are you getting to the next caller that's on hold quickly enough? And they have brought that down closer to the goal. And the very last one, the average speed to answer in seconds, has to do with just, again, the promptness of which that they're answering the call. Probably our biggest issue that's arisen over the last couple of months, because we had a little bit of instability at the beginning when we were just getting the call center set up, but it wasn't too bad. But right now, what we're dealing with is the quality and the training of the call center staff themselves. They're only able to answer kind of the most simplistic kinds of calls, and we're going to have a team of people from the state actually go down there this week, which will be our second trip, to do some training with them. So that's been a bit of a challenge. I think it's been a challenge for the providers as well. They call into the call center and they can't always get their calls. About 50% of them get escalated to the state. And because we don't have the staff at the state level, we can't return them as quickly as we would like to. So if that ends my testimony, I'd answer any additional questions you might have at this time.
Any questions? Representative Weiss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jenny, you guys stopped claims processing in the transition, and so you accumulated. And now, at least on your data, you're processing at a lower rate than before. What's your time frame, I guess, to get back up, you know, to get current?
Yep.
So that, because I've certainly been getting those questions from some providers on, you know, how long is this going to take?
Chairman Olmans and Representative Weiss, I think that the throughput of the claims has not been diminished. It's just that we're denying more claims, so the frustration is still the same. Do you know what I'm saying? So we did have a blackout period, and the processing of the claims that had been resubmitted during the blackout period or submitted during the blackout period, I believe that we're relatively current in terms of submitted claims to processing them. One of the things that this new system does, it adjudicates claims every day. So it's not like in the old system that used to adjudicate just once a week. So providers can go out and see their claim status more readily. But I think what is happening is that there's more claims being denied, so they're not getting payment, or they're confused by why they're not getting denied, and the call center isn't extremely helpful right now in helping them to navigate their remittance advice. We actually have fewer claims in suspense. When I had testified a few months ago, we had anticipated that we would have a growing suspense backlog because of just complexities with the system. But right now, we're right around 25,000, and we thought we'd be double that by right now. But it's in concert with the fact that a portion of those claims that would go into suspense are actually being auto-denied. That's a long answer. I hope I answered your question.
Continue.
Not completely.
Okay.
I understand the denial part, so if I'm trying to get through of everything you said here, in other words, you're saying that the backlog is taken care of, as you're processing claims at a faster rate than your current, but there's more denials, and so then, of course, they have to be reprocessed, so that we're really not behind already anymore as far as initial processing of claims?
Chairman Owens and Representative Weiss, I think we're pleased with the progress that we're making in terms of the payment cycles. Okay. The claims we do have in suspense, there are some known system issues related to third-party liability and some of those things, so I wouldn't say that we feel we're out of the weeds yet, but we're getting very close. I think another month of stabilization, and if we can get on top of those top reasons for denials and do more provider outreach to help them educate the providers on how to correctly submit their claims, I think we're in pretty good shape.
Any further questions? Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Next on the agenda is education-related information technologies, North Dakota University System.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Darren King. I am not Lisa Feldner. I am the Deputy Chief Information Officer for the university system. Dr. Feldner was unavailable today, and she asked me to fill in and give you a briefing on some of the major initiatives underway, specifically in the IT area. So we've spent an awful lot of time working with six primary projects, and these are those listed, and each of those is a result of some sort of legislative action. And so obviously, those are our priorities. We're doing dozens and dozens of other things throughout our organization, but these have taken a great deal of our attention. One of the things to note is that we've spent about the last year trying to build out our project management and procurement capabilities. That was an area that Dr. Feldner saw after having spent time at ITD and watching how effective their system is, that we needed to build that capacity. And right now, we feel like we're in a pretty good place with it. I would say we're still immature in that, but we're certainly better than we were. So you'll see some of the things here. There's some project management methodology we're working on. We're not quite to that point where you'll start to see the same type of reporting you're seeing from the state, but we're certainly working towards that. First item is security, and there was an appropriation for us to do a number of different security initiatives, and this graphic lays out really the framework for what we have spent the last year developing and working towards. Building from the bottom up, data classification, understanding the data we have and how we should classify it. Is it restricted data? Is it private data? Is it public data? And making sure that that's very clear across the university system. We have done a lot of work with cybersecurity and the frameworks around it to try to start to match where we're at and what we're doing with what the standards and framework are. We've begun the process of building policy and standards and procedures that will continue throughout the winter for us. And then the pillars are all individual projects that we have kicked off or are in the process of kicking off. Multi-factor authentication is underway. We're phasing that in based on systems that we feel have data classifications that require multi-factor, so that will be an ongoing process over the course of the next few months. Endpoint protection, we have an RFP ready to go on the street to look for a solution for better endpoint protection across the system. We continue to do training and awareness activities. We do that a lot internally within our own organization. We're with our CIO Council Subcommittee on Security. They're talking about how do we then extend that out to campuses and provide training and awareness resources all the way out to campus levels. Sensitive information discovery, that's an area that we're just in the process of trying to build a project charter for that. That is a little bit like endpoint protection. Sometimes they can be in the same suite, but really what we're talking about there is how do we know when there is sensitive information where it shouldn't be, and then how do we alert and mitigate that? And then vulnerability management, we've done quite a bit with that, and we continue to do it, trying to build a more enterprise approach to how we manage vulnerabilities across not just the system office, but also across campuses. And then centralized logging. We do an awful lot of logging right now to the tune of, tens of 20s of gigabytes a day of logging. We need a better system to manage that when you've got that volume of information. So we have the project charter in place. We've got program charters being built for each of these areas, some of them further along than others. So we've certainly done an awful lot of work in this area and have an awful lot of work yet to go. It might be easier to take questions after each slide since I'm going to kind of bombard you with six big topics. So are there questions on this?
Continue, please.
Okay. Identity and access management. If you recall, there was appropriation to the university system to replace a end-of-life identity and access management system. We spent the winter doing a current future state study across the system to understand what it is we do today when it comes to identity and access management, and what do we think the latest in the industry does, and how can we then move to that. We developed a project charter, we released an RFP, and we have 9 respondents to that. So the first piece of it is a product to replace it, along with implementation services. We expect to award that sometime this month, and then start contract negotiations, hopefully with a kickoff in March with that. So identity and access management, what that will help us do is become far more efficient in how we manage our users across the system to try to right now, the current system, because it's 8 or 9 years old, there's a lot of moving parts. There's a lot of human interaction that has to happen. You know, modern systems should not do that. We should be able to provision and deprovision accounts using data that already exists, so no human has to do that. We should also then be able to apply access and security privileges in a more dynamic manner. So that's where we're headed with identity and access management. It's very much a security initiative in my mind. Questions? Okay, thank you. Data inconsistencies. Again, through legislative requests, there were a number of data inconsistencies identified that the university system was directed to rectify and clean up. These are not really technology issues, but we are definitely facilitating the project. There's an awful lot there. I think there were 8 or 9 listed in the bill, but when you really start to look at it, it's closer to 40 different data inconsistencies. So we broke that up by trying to look at who owns that data across the university system. So student affairs owns some of it, academic affairs owns some of it. Who are the owners of these inconsistencies? And then we broke it up into phases so that we could, when it made sense, partner some of these efficiencies together and deal with them once. At other times, spread them out a little bit because we're going to have to use the same resources to help solve these. So there you can see the high-level schedule. If you're interested, I could certainly provide you way more detailed information about what each of those phases are. And these are work groups from the campuses that will be working through each one of these phases and each one of these specific inconsistencies to come to an agreement on how to rectify it. We've already done a few. We're successfully done demographic information is already syncing between the two systems. That piece is done, but we've got a lot more to do. Data inconsistencies, questions?
I will ask you to provide a description of the four-phase approach, though, just so everybody understands, just rather than saying,
sure,
four-phase approach.
Yeah, so out of those 40 or so identified pieces of data that we're not collecting the same across the university system. So maybe an example is the best. So, you know, are we defining an online student exactly the same across the system? We might be putting it in the system and it looks like it is, but are we truly defining it? So there's a specific data inconsistency. There's a certain group of people at the campus that own that, that are the ones that are at the campus level working with that data every day. Those are the people that we need to have together to decide what's the best way to move forward to resolve that inconsistency. And like I said, there's almost 40 of those, and they're individual working groups. So within each one of these phases, we're taking about 25% of those identified data inconsistencies and knocking them off, having the group come together, make the decisions on what they should be and how we're all going to go forward with the same data. So, and like I said, I could give you, like, specific to each inconsistency if you chose. I'd have to send it off to you, but questions?
Any questions? Continue, please.
Okay. Functional consolidation, again, one that through legislative action with the goal of trying to consolidate services across the university system, very similar to how ITD operates. We have a project charter that's been complete with an executive steering committee on board with this. Over the course of December and January, we will be doing a whole bunch of data gathering. This week that starts from the campuses, trying to identify what technical services are they running on their campus. We have to have all that put together first. In parallel, we're developing the policy and procedure that goes with that. And we will get to about March when we're going to start looking at systems and making recommendations and perhaps already identifying some waivered areas. It's very likely that there will be things that we see as things that can be consolidated rather quickly and for low or no cost that we'd like to get started with right away. There will likely be a batch of things, of systems that fall into that category that when that system becomes end of life, we'll absorb it in. You know, we don't want to take a a brand-new piece of equipment and put it on the shelf. Will that work out? So they'll get a temporary waiver, and then there's another group of things that we likely will not want to consolidate. But until we get the data gathered, we're not exactly sure what those are. So that's the process in December and January with each campuses. There's a paper process they're helping us with right now. Myself and Dr. Feldner and our project manager will visit every campus in January to confirm all those things. We'll go back, get to the recommendation phase, and then we'll go back and visit every campus again, just to make sure that everybody's on the same page with what we're thinking with functional consolidation. And the business cases, that's the last piece, because there's also likely going to be things that we would see as something that could obviously be consolidated, but there's perhaps a fiscal note attached to it. You know, it's one of those things, to gain efficiency, you might have to invest to get long-term efficiencies. So that's what business cases mean to us, that when we get to that point where, you know, we find this thing that really makes sense to consolidate, but we also know there's a price tag associated with it. Questions on functional consolidation?
Any questions? So you should have a good, a general, based on the timeline you just said about visiting, and have a good idea of some of the functional and consolidation that you might want to consider come the March meeting.
Absolutely, yep.
Seeing none, please continue.
Email archiving and consolidation. Now, we put these two together. They're very closely related. If you recall, they're a bill to have all non-student email archived for 2 years. It also lays out that everybody needs to be in the same email system. So we took these two together. We have 7 campus consolidated in the past calendar year. So we're 7 out of 11 right now with consolidated email, which also means that, of course, it's in the same archiving system also. We have 4 left to go. They're perhaps the most complicated of the batch. We have issued a RFP actually just yesterday for professional services to help us with that. We expect to award that in February and begin that work shortly after that. So the good news is we're 7 out of 11 towards being on a single email system, and the future is let's get these last 4 done. So I think we're positioned well to do that. Questions? Okay.
Please continue.
Predictive analytics and interventions. I'm not sure if this committee has had a presentation on predictive analytics. I know we have given the presentations to the higher. Oh, I'm sorry.
Excuse me. Senator Russ.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. King. Who are the 4?
Chairman Owens, Representative Rust. The 4 are NDSU, Mayville, Valley City, and Minot.
Thank you.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What type of an email system was decided on to be the centrally managed single service? Is that hosted here in the state? Is it who's it hosted by, and what's the technology?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Olson, it's Office 365. It's a hosted solution from Microsoft. It's more or less free for higher education. It's not, and nothing's ever free, we know that, but it certainly is a very cost-effective cloud solution for us.
Any other questions? Senator Russ?
No.
Please continue.
Okay, so thank you. Predictive analytics, like I said, we have done some pretty detailed demos with the higher ed interim committee on this, and we'd be more than happy to come and give you more information on this. But in a nutshell, really what we're doing is we're gathering common data sets from all of our campuses and using a big data tool that's part of a consortium to build out predictive models with that, that campuses can use, that we can use as a system, where not only can we look at campus level, but system level and national level comparisons with predictives. There's a lot of training that's involved in that we're doing. Ultimately, we want to get to where that data is actionable. So we have campus intervention teams that, as we start to learn more and more about what it does look like, what does a successful student look like, that we can then have good ways to intervene and help students at the end. We've done 4 schools so far, so we're just getting started with that. The data transform, the ETL, is a pretty large task. It's completely anonymized data, so we're not sending any data that can be identified to a particular student into this system. It's completely anonymized. And we're building a little bit of momentum here, because every campus we do, we get a little better at it. So I don't think, we've only done 4 in 6 months. I don't think it's going to take us, you know, times 3 to get the rest of them in. You know, we're picking up steam as we go with this. So.
Questions? Please.
So that's what I have, Chairman Owens. I'd be happy to either go back, take other questions that anybody may have.
Anyone have any questions? You said at the beginning something about getting your program managers in track and getting your program management process in track. I was just curious. It hit me. And your program managers, do they require PMP certification?
Chairman Owens, no, but we're actively training them to that. So we're right now, we're 2 out of 4 of our program, our project managers are certified, and the others are working towards it. They have a dual role too, because they're also becoming certified as procurement officers also. Now we're doing both of those out of the same office.
Are they subject matter experts?
They are not. That's one of the things we're trying to, you know, previously project management in our organization, it was a subject matter expert, not just being the subject matter expert, but also doing the project management. And, you know, we wanted a separate office and to be able to be that independent voice. And they're very technical people, don't get me wrong, but, you know, we're relying on the subject matter experts based on what it is we're trying to accomplish. The project manager is very much a project manager.
Well, no, I'm not suggesting either way. I was just curious. Any other questions? Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Next on the agenda, we're just a little ahead of schedule.
Chairman Owens, if I could.
Oh, yes.
Dr. Hagerot also wanted to say a few
words. Oh, please.
Okay. As part of our time.
Thank you, sir. For the record, I'm Mark Hagerot, your chancellor. And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thanks for taking a few minutes out of your schedule to allow me to talk briefly about an initiative we're kicking off, which I briefed to the Chancellor's Cabinet, made of the Presidents, the State Board, as well as I talked briefly with, I guess, Economic Development Subcommittee about implications for high-performance computing. But what I want to talk about briefly is the cybersecurity education initiative that we are assembling all the campuses together. We had our first meeting a couple days ago, actually last Thursday, and it's to support the Governor's Task Force on Cybersecurity. And I know most of you here have pretty technical backgrounds, but the big picture is we have a massive explosion of digital machines, unmanned machines, big data, the Internet of Things, and there is a huge, massive security vulnerability across all systems, all people, from the Defense Department, Homeland Security, to trade, to banking, and estimates are that workforce shortfalls are in the millions in our country, but not just for a shortfall of workers do we want to have this initiative, but also for the fact that we want our people in North Dakota to have a workforce that knows what's going on. You know, if we have to outsource everything, we don't have North Dakota people who know how this works, we don't have North Dakota people creating these companies, we really lose control of our own, you know, our own state, our own people, our own economy. And there'll be certain things, as we're talking about, subject matter experts that are at Microsoft. Thankfully, we have the third biggest campus in the country. It happens to be here in North Dakota. But it's both a goal of creating wealth, jobs, workforce in our state, supporting the governor's initiative, supporting the Air Force, Department of Defense. But also, it's for our people coming through. You know, 47,000 students. If we can get more and more of them to be able to take some courses, there's going to be some basic courses at the 2-year, the 4-year, and research level. We want to reach all those levels. So we're kicking this initiative off. And we'll probably do it by tier, the 2-year, 4-year, and then the research level, so that we'll produce certificates, degrees for our businesses at a low level, a medium, and then at a high level, perhaps starting companies, patents. Two implications for cybersecurity spill over in the other parts of my initiative. It's called North Dakota Nexus, or Tech Nexus, is unmanned systems. and high-performance computing. So if you take those three together, unmanned systems, high-performance computing, and cybersecurity, we have a real chance to create a, you know, a new engine for jobs, diversify our economy. And as you well know, and this is through your leadership and others, we are leader in the world now of unmanned system support to the Air Force and precision agriculture. And so both cybersecurity and high-performance computing can support that as well. Why does high-performance computing tie in? A lot of what you do to train and test cybersecurity workforce, and that was my job at the Naval Academy, is done in a virtual world. You have to run big computers to simulate. You don't want someone attacking the grid for real. You want to be able to simulate the grid, simulate third, fourth, fifth order effects, and then critique later how your students did protecting the grid. Also, why the emphasis on people? The reality is, I think it was Verizon did a study, up to 94% of the penetrations of networks were human errors. People making mistakes, plugging things in, not understanding their systems. You can have the best experts back in Silicon Valley, but if your workforce doesn't have a certain level of knowledge, that's where the mistakes are made. So creating jobs, creating new companies, diversifying our economy, helping North Dakotans be better and control their systems, but also just securing what we already have. We're trying to lend a hand with that. So we just had our first meetings, and you'll be glad to know that many of your campuses are already doing quite a bit of work on that. But other campuses are very close to shutting some things down because it was disjointed. There just wasn't enough critical mass at say, you know, one of the campuses. But if you actually work a consortium working across the 11 campuses, we can keep that going and offer a system solution. So I just want to take a few minutes in case you hear about that. Glad to come back anytime and talk in more detail about the initiative. And we're working with this gentleman here as well, obviously, as a team. Any questions?
Well, thank you, Chancellor. Any questions? You're doing fine until you said you're working with him.
No, okay. Well, he's going back to school. We're going to train him some more. That's right.
Any questions? Well, thank you so much for dropping by. Well,
thanks for what you're doing on this committee. I'm not trying to suck up to you all, but I think it's one of the most important committees we have going, if you're in the world that I was in. It's just an amazing time in history. So thanks for the time you're taking, and hopefully beat the snow on your way out today. So, thank you.
Thanks. Education Technology. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Jody French, and I serve as the Educational Technology Director, and we also provide supervision for EduTech and the Center for Distance Education. I got a little wordy on my slide, so I'll just try to highlight some of these pieces. Just to review, the Council has been fortunate enough to work on two grant projects. One is the Build that provides personalized learning for schools. That is state funds. And that deadline has passed, and 76% of those funds have been requested from schools, and we'll be awarding those December 18th. My next step is to find out why the other percent wasn't requested from those schools, find out if it was a lack of communication or what the issue was. We also received a large rural utilities systems grant that's under the USDA to upgrade equipment in three ITV consortiums. We've been working a lot on student data protection, my office and EduTech providing training resources and support to schools so they can implement the new policy passed in the last legislative session where they have to provide better measures for protecting student data. We're working with NDSU to provide a cybersecurity conference for all of K-20 as well as government and industry, and that's coming up in March. Our data steward works feverishly helping schools use data along with the work that she already does. She's working on the new SLDS grant, that's the data utilization project, focusing on instructional support and college and career readiness. She was also asked to serve on the NWA National Task Force. That's the map testing that a lot of schools do. And their initiatives are very similar with the work she was already doing, and that's on the SLDS grant. So we are really happy that our work can be very focused on things like assessment, education, and literacy for teachers. In the EduTech world, PowerSchool, the student information system, things are going well. User groups, upgrades, working with the SLDS and e-transcripts, a lot of demand for those services. Professional development in the IT area, a lot of our work is focused on Office 365, final implementation of the Active Directory, providing professional development for teachers in the areas of makerspace, careers, social media. Those are just a few statistics. Along with those services, we've noticed an increase in our help desk services, 7% over the last year, 37% in the last 2 years. I attribute that to Active Directory, rollout of Office 365, and amazingly, the retirement of Sendit. I am one of the Sendit pioneers. I've had that email account for almost 25 years, and those are going away in January. E-rate, the K-12 portion of StageNet under E-rate has been funded. There is a USAC audit in process. We never like to hear the word audit, but we feel like that's going very well, that we've provided that audit team all of the information they need to get this process started. Schools have received over $5 million in funding. Schools are eligible, like in the next 5 years, for up to $15 million. For internal connection, that rolls on a 5-year cycle. So schools may not need to improve their internal networks right now, but within this 5-year period, they have access to a fair amount of money to do that. In order to ensure that happens for schools, EduTech provides a lot of training on filling out those E-rate forms because they're fairly complex, and one of our staff travels across the state trying to meet all of those requirements. Finally, the Center for Distance Education, I'm happy to report that that enrollment growth has stabilized. I came to you 3 months ago with a lot of concern that we weren't budgeted to manage all of those enrollments. We see some stability in that area. And that allows us to focus on streamlining all of our systems. I think we are on target to have 94% of our students complete their courses. We're reaching a student in every district. Constant communication between those teachers and students in the schools. In the course of improvement, these are some things that we're doing to build new programs, new profit centers to kind of balance those large increases in enrollment that we see from time to time, moving into to a smart lab, which is a STEM lab that helps students K through 12 prepare for STEM-oriented careers. I talked a little bit at our last meeting about an experiment providing special education services online. Those consortiums came to us, and they just needed a broker to help them figure out how do we get special ed services online when there's such a shortage of teachers. I'm happy to report that that's working well. There's a little bit of skepticism. Schools truly would love that individual at the school, but this online environment is certainly meeting their needs. The CDE is finally retiring all of their print courses. They're going to be doing a final sale of them. There's colony schools and Hutterite schools and home schools that actually want to buy those assets. After that, everything will be 100% online. There isn't a future for print. We haven't updated those courses. They're not the quality that we would like them to be, so it's definitely time to move those into retirement. Working more closely with the career and technical education, making sure that our enrollment processes are streamlined. One of the CDE's biggest challenges is working with vendors. All of our online courses are procured from vendors. Sometimes they're not the best content, or there's errors in their content, there's errors in their assessments and their teacher keys. We have one particular vendor that we had to negotiate a large price reduction in. We plan to move away from that vendor because they are just not keeping up with the quality agreements that we have in place with them. The center is also working very closely on security, making sure that they are protecting student privacy, making sure that all their teacher devices have dual authentication, and taking advantage of the Office 365 implementation to K-12, making those things available for their teachers and their students. As you know, all of our customers live in a world where they want this information in online learning on their mobile devices. We're trying to eliminate all of our paper, make sure that our entry and enrollment processes don't have errors so that we can quickly support that student, because a kid wants to enroll and they want to start right away. That's the world that they live in. And along with that, we need to provide better information and control for the exam administrators back at the schools. So it's a circular motion of providing quality and improved services for the students, their parents, the exam administrators, and the administrators and teachers at the actual brick and mortar school. That is the update on our organizations. I'm happy to respond to any questions you might have.
Any questions? You answered them all before they knew to ask them.
Thank you.
Thank you. That brings us to the 210.
and it's Information Technology Council of North Dakota.
Good afternoon, Chairman Owens and members of the committee. My name is Dina Wheezy. I'm the Executive Director for the Information Technology Council of North Dakota, and just want to thank you for providing an opportunity to give an update on the Dakota Fiber Initiative, which ITC&D has been working on for the past couple years. ITC&D was created in 2000 by North Dakota business, government, and education leaders to recognize the need to actively encourage the youth growth and development of IT in North Dakota. And today, our membership is made up of about 90 members representing business, government, and education. Several of you were on this committee previously and had heard prior updates, but there are a lot of new faces as well, so I'll give you a little background on the Dakota Fiber Initiative to start out with. The objective is to provide affordable, world-class internet speed and reliability to every individual in the state of North Dakota. The initiative was rolled out during the 2013 State of Technology event in Fargo that was hosted by Senator Hoven and the Fargo-Moorhead-West Fargo Chamber. And at that conference, Doug Burgum had shared his vision for North Dakota to have the highest speed and greatest bandwidth internet infrastructure in the world by 2015 through partnerships with public and private sector. Well, we are at the end of 2015 now, so we'll see how we did. ITC&D championed the initiative given its infrastructure development goal of working for affordable access to state-of-the-art voice, video, and data services for all of North Dakota. In addition, ITC&D is a statewide entity that represents both the supply and demand side of the broadband issue. So ITC&D, in cooperation with private and public sector stakeholders, launched the initiative in October of 2013. At the onset, we knew that North Dakota had significant bandwidth coverage across the state. However, initial discussions were really focused around inadequate speeds, affordability of adequate speed, and then assurance that capacity can meet future demands, understanding the world's not slowing down in regard to broadband. Both supply and demand data existed, but there was a need to compile that, identify gaps, and also look at the affordability issues. So that's what we had took on over the past couple years. In terms of results, the state's telecommunications providers really rose to the challenge and have done an outstanding job in providing broadband to North Dakotans. You'll hear from a couple gentlemen representing the telecommunications industry in a couple minutes here, and they'll be able to provide a lot more information in that regard. But we are number one in the country for providing high-speed fiber optic access, and that's according to USDA Rural Development, and number three for its share of residents with access to gigabit speed upload and download service at 58%, and that's according to the FCC. Since the Dakota Fiber Initiative was kicked off, numerous telecommunications providers have announced the rollout of gigabit services to their constituents within the next several years, which will provide North Dakota with a competitive edge. Benefits of this connectivity include ability for businesses to compete globally, schools to provide distance education learning opportunities, and remote healthcare consultations to occur, and personal connections to be enhanced. In terms of next steps, ITC&D is going to continue to monitor the broadband access and affordability across the state and support expansion when possible. We'd ask, as you're considering future policy, that you would consider the inclusion of broadband infrastructure along the side of traditional infrastructure incentives and funding, as it truly is the infrastructure of the future. In addition, there is also strong support for permanency of the telecommunications infrastructure sales and use tax exemption. That's set to expire in 2017 and is currently being looked at by the Interim Economic Development Committee as well. That's one incentive in all of our discussions, pretty intense discussions on policy over the past a couple years that both broadband providers and users agree has been extremely beneficial in accelerating the availability and affordability of broadband across the state. So we would urge you to take a close look at that during the upcoming session. A huge opportunity exists to further diversify the state's economy by attracting high-tech service industries. The Chancellor spoke to that previously, too. North Dakota's high-tech economy remains underdeveloped as it lags behind the nation in this area by 34%. These industries are important targets for economic development as they return a significant economic impact back to the state. I thank you for the opportunity to provide an update on the Dakota Fiber Initiative. I'd be happy to answer any questions. And if you guys don't have questions, I do have Mr. David Crothers and Seth Arndorfer to provide some additional information for you.
Senator Russ.
Mr. Chairman, Dina. Mm-hmm. Is it Dina?
Yes, yep.
Do you know the dollar amount that the state of North Dakota would lose as a result of that infrastructure sales and use tax?
I don't. There is a study that I believe actually Representative Thorson had sent to me previously that had put some numbers to it, so maybe I could work with him to get you some information on that.
Yeah,
maybe he knows it.
Representative Thorson?
Okay, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, there was a study done it's probably been a year or two now, and I forget it was a professor. I'm trying to remember. I'll try and find it, but it kind of showed the success stories of where these North Dakota and there was one other state compared to other states which had not done what we've done here. So I'll try and find that, and I can forward it to you or to council or to Dina, and we'll get it out.
Mr. Chairman.
Please, continue.
My understanding is there are, seven states total that would be affected by that? Is that correct?
Chairman Owens and Senator Russ, that would be affected by the by the tax credit if it went away?
Right.
Exemption?
I think the rest of them do not have the tax now, but I thought I saw seven states that do have the tax and would stand to lose millions in that process, as I recall.
Chairman and Senator, I believe it's our incentive is strictly just for North Dakota. It's not a federal incentive. It's a state tax exemption, so I'm not sure how that correlates, but.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Look. Here comes some information.
Which page is the college football prediction on?
I can give them to you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is David Crothers with the North Dakota Association of Telephone Cooperatives. If you'll forgive me, I'm just getting over a cold here. But when Ms. Wheezy asked if we could assist or offer some insight, of course, we were delighted. But second is we put a book together that wanted to give big picture perspective of where North Dakota stood with broadband. As I noted earlier, I just work for the independent telephone industry in the state. And if you go to the very first page, the red page, you will see an outline of the state of North Dakota, but that which is red is the area served by the independent industry. The independent industry is referred to as the telephone cooperatives and the small commercial companies. In North Dakota, virtually all owned by residents of North Dakota, and it does not include the bigger carriers, the price cap carriers, the CenturyLinks of the world. So in those are the providers in the state of North Dakota. If I can direct you to the first tab, you're going to see a rust-colored page there, Akini's State of the Internet, first quarter 2015, and I'll ask you to go to page 18 of that report. We're going to go through a couple pages as we go through. So when we get to page 18, and I wanted—it's somewhat cumbersome—but I wanted to—I did want to cherry pick some numbers out of this report, so you have the entire report. But when you get to page 18, we compare states within the United States, and you'll see the first column at the bottom of page 18. In North Dakota, ranks 10th in the nation in average connection speed. And if you go to the graph or to the column immediately to the right, you'll see North Dakota ranks 7th at 66.9 megabits per peak speeds. The average connection speed was 14. And then if you'll go to the next page, you will see that North Dakota ranks 4th for the adoption of 4 megabits and greater at 88%, 4th in the nation. In the column next to that, 10 megabits or greater, North Dakota ranks 8th. And then if you'll go to the next page, at page 20, you'll see that North Dakota ranks 8th at 8.6, who have customers, subscribers, who've adopted 25 meg or more. I will next direct you to page 24. And now we have the Americas, the North and Central America. And the first column is average connection speed. You'll remember from page 18, North Dakota ranked 14 megabits. You will see that North Dakota would, in fact, the state of North Dakota leads the nation, leads the Americas at 14. The United States is first in the Americas with 11.9. If you'll go to the next column, which is identified as figure 19, you'll see that, remember, North Dakota had 66.9 once again on page 18. That also would lead North, the United States is the leader in the Americas at 53.3. So now we'll move on to Asia, and that begins on page 30. We so frequently hear about where the United States ranks in these horrible numbers in the state by implication, so we're bringing this to you to offer some perspective. On page 30, we're back at the first column, average connection speed. Remember, that was page 18. North Dakota was 14. Compared to all the Asian countries, North Dakota would be 4th. South Korea, Hong Kong, Japan, 1, 2, and 3, and North Dakota would be 4th. And in the next column, average peak connection, remember North Dakota was 66.9, North Dakota would be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6th at 66.9, just behind Japan. I'll ask you to go to page 36, and we'll do the European countries. We've done the Americas, we've done Asia, and now the European countries. Once again, the average connection speed, North Dakota is at 14. Norway in fifth place is at 14.1, so we would be sixth there. And in the next column, North Dakota at 66.9 would in fact rank third throughout all of the European countries. The following page is... I'm sorry, there is no following page. It's too much. Okay, so we will go to, if you'll go to your next tab, your clear tab, I believe it'll be, you're going to see a map, the state of broadband in the states. It's a Washington Post article from June of this year. It'll be your second tab.
Washington Post article. And the first thing you'll see is this blue and white map. And you'll note that North Dakota's at 66.9. We're going to get to a, in just a moment, we're going to get to a listing of all the states and countries to see where North Dakota would rank. But at 66.9, we'd like to point out one thing. From the state of Virginia West, only one state has higher average peak speed than North Dakota. That's Utah at 67.9. North Dakota is at 66.9. When we were asked to come and share a perspective of internet availability in rural North Dakota, we thought this would be beneficial. We'll go from our map now to the next page. You see the absolute fastest is Singapore, then Hong Kong, and then we have the states. Delaware, Virginia, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, Utah, and D.C., of course, not a state. And at the top of the next page, you have the state of North Dakota at 66.9. This is an exact representation of what you saw on the map on the previous page, but it gives you a sense of how North Dakota compares to the other states and also the other countries in the world.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Rush.
Yeah, interrupt. Sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Curlers, when you start talking average peak speed, average can be a term that is kind of nebulous, you know? And I'm wondering, in this average, in when you look at the speeds within North Dakota, is there a difference, say, eastern part of North Dakota versus western, northern versus southern, rural versus urban, as far as one being substantially higher than another, so the average gets brought up?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ross, I think the answer to your question is yes. And I think it's primarily the rural that raises the state average. After we go through this book, there's a map at the very back of this book. We can go through some of those companies, and I'll explain some of the deployment and speeds offered and investment that's currently ongoing in rural North Dakota. Now, that doesn't, I believe that brings the average up. I don't mean to say rural's good, urban is bad. That's not my intention at all. But when I go through the map, and we may want to revisit the question then, sir. Thank you, sir. So you've had an opportunity to go through the states compared to the countries, and so we will go to the next tab. That will take us to broadband. Now get fiber optic internet in the United States. And if you'll go in three pages, you'll see fiber providers availability by state. And you'll see the percentage of the population covered by fiber and the number of the population covered as well. This is not from top to bottom in the availability by percentage of population covered, but rather alphabetical. And if you go to page 3, you'll find the state of North Dakota with 59.5% of the population covered, and that ranks 6th in the nation, 0.5% behind the state of Maryland. And absent any questions, we'll just move into the next tab, and you will see E-rate pricing data. This is from the FCC based on what the states report to them. Once again, you will see the states listed alphabetically. If you go to page 3 of that handout in your book, you'll see that North Dakota is substantially less than virtually any other state. By my calculation, North Dakota is the third most affordable behind the states of Vermont and Nevada. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'd invite you to, at the last page, you'll see a map that folds out North Dakota telephone exchange areas. There has been a tremendous amount of investment in rural North Dakota for a variety of reasons. Primarily, the needs of those at the end of the line, the subscribers, the customers, the members of the North Dakota industry. I don't have the ability or knowledge to speak for the other providers. And when you look at the map, you'll see that each of the colored areas is served by an independent telephone company. There's actually a legend of sorts on the back. But the white areas within the state of North Dakota, are those areas served by CenturyLink. One of the ways that the independent industry believes the customers, the members, the owners, the subscribers of our companies are best served is by investment in infrastructure. The economic needs, the educational, the entertainment, the requirements that those customer needs get more and more sophisticated. Pair that with the technological evolution to greater speed, greater capacity, greater affordability, and you'll see that the independent telephone industry has moved on to graduated, started deploying fiber optics. When fiber optics came out, we started connecting our central offices in each exchange to facilitate the movement of telecom traffic. That fiber build-out has been pushed out now. So we see it going out from the central office to individual homes. Complete change-out of the homes, the businesses, the hospitals. Mr. Arndorfer is here from Dakota Carrier Network, can talk about the tremendous use and capacity, as can Mr. Ressler, with the anchor institutions. I'm visiting exclusively about homes in very small businesses. So we built that fiber out. When you look at this map, you will see, on the western part of the state, Consolidated Telecom is virtually 100% built out fiber to the home. The speeds that this affords a customer of Consolidated Telecom is phenomenal. West River Telecom, and I actually can go through company by company, which each exchange has done. West River has built out 60% of their service territory, about 40% of their customers, to have fiber to the home right now. Beck in the yellow is 100% fiber to the home. Dakota Central is virtually 100% fiber to the home and will be at the end of next year. Dickey Rural in the blue, the greenish blue on the South Dakota border, East Central is 100% of fiber to the home. Beck, Dickey Rural, Dakota Central, that area, those three companies may be the largest contiguous area of fiber to the home anywhere on the planet. Red River Telephone up against the Minnesota border and on the South Dakota border has 100% of their rural customers fiber to the home, to the premise, and will have 100% of the four remaining towns on next year. If we go to the northeast, you see Polar, that is 100% fiber to the premise today. The speeds that are available to customers today in North Dakota are virtually unparalleled. With fiber to the home in the proper electronics, gig service is available in Mott today. And it is in town after town after town in rural North Dakota. North Dakota Telephone Company is building out. They're about halfway done. United Telephone, they're going to be done at the end of next year. SRT, they can offer 100 meg any place within their company right now. Northwest, in the far northwestern corner of the state, they're in the midst of a large build-out right now. Mr. Rust, you asked the question a moment ago. If you'll indulge me for a moment, I'll indulge me and show me the alphabet, Round Prairie, Epping, Rural Ray, Wild Rose, McGregor, Powers Lake, the rural Powers Lake, Columbus, and rural Crosby are gig-capable today. And so when we go through the state of North Dakota, when you ask for a snapshot of rural broadband, we wanted to come in and show you the state in general and the state of North Dakota in particular. Mr. Chairman, if there's something obvious that I'm missing, I'd be delighted to answer any questions. But also, anytime the committee would like further information on what the state of North Dakota is doing or the members of the association or a particular company, we'd be delighted to answer that.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Crothers, these are impressive numbers, impressive results, but do you have any idea of the costs that have been associated with this to the state, either through the form of incentives or subsidies, tax exemptions, that sort of thing? I'd like to see some information that can kind of quantify the cost alongside the benefit and the results that we have.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Olson, the only cost to the state of North Dakota would be for that sales tax exemption if it were in fact claimed. So that would be the beginning and end of that on the state side. And the question came up earlier, and I don't remember the fiscal note on what the sales tax exemption cost. I believe when they started digging into it, it wasn't a very high number. It was a surprisingly low number. A lot of that was a question of whether people had been, companies had been applying for it. So it was lower than we expected it to be.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, and did I also hear we were going to, we have representatives from Dakota Fiber, or that's what we just went over. Comments from interesting parties? Any additional comments from attendees? Okay, committee, you have before you, or you're about to get handed out, a letter from Secretary of State, I believe, in reference to requirement of them reporting to us. So we're going to just hand this out during this part as part of the amendment to Section 50 of Chapter 257 of the 2013 session laws required them to do this. So any other committee discussions on what we've heard today, or any thoughts in general? Anyone, you don't have to be shy. This is your committee. You should feel free to speak. No. Nothing? All right. Well, then I'm going to ask Mr. Resler to be kind enough to invite us March meeting to his new building up north so that we would hold the meeting there.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, be delighted to do that.
And with that, well, I don't remember the exact date. Adam, do you remember? March 10th.
Mr. Chairman, we'll order the sun in so that it'll be a sunny day.
Okay, and I understand Representative Weiss will bring lunch.
So, and DCN is our neighbor. They could cook us some burgers or something if
there,
the lunch
there we
is
go. There we go. There we go. Okay. All righty. Well, with that, then March 10th. If there's, let me know, committee members, if something you've heard now or the minutes, and you think about this later and it jogs your memory, of something specifically we would like to hear about or an update on or discuss in the March meeting, let me know, and we'll get Adam to, you know, contact them and make sure they're there.
Other than that, if there's no further questions, comments, or business, meeting's adjourned.
You know, it'd be better if I put in a summary for you, but you've got that as a... The only reason I did that book was so no one knows me.
I like
you. I got 16 books to talk about.
By the way, we're not going to the same place at our same school.
Oh, I had it before my annual, right at the end of my annual meeting. Then I felt better in Washington. Now I got it again.
I had two. Thank you again, by the way.
I've never done the presentations with anybody before. I've always done them on my own. I did actually one time with Art, but he would self-admit he couldn't let go of it, so he would.
I never noticed that.
He spent 18 hours one week arguing with me about it. You want to do the presentations? And I was like, dude, what are you? There's no reason I have this panic attack. Either you do it or I do it. So I ended up just standing there watching him most of it, but it was, that part was kind of weird to me because I was, he was really stressed and I, do you want to do it? Yeah, I'll do it. Well, I want to do it. Well,
then do it.
Like, who's on first, what's on second? And then, you know, I was, by the time I was done, I was just around doing the presentation. No, Steve and I actually are still individually. I mean, but because of our stand-up and some of our other meetings, so that would be no problem.
Yeah, I will definitely keep in touch with you about it. Maybe even, so, are you going to have the center? Do you have to slot?
Yeah, that's a lot to see about that.
Oh, thank you. I feel like I'm a little bit more, but you know, when they're all staring at you.
Okay.
Good job.
So, what's